Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 47, Felix Unger Wisdom.
This Week in Law is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Do more and travel less with GoToMeeting. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com/TWiL.
Hi, and welcome back to This Week in Law, Episode 47. I'm Denise Howell, and this week we have a mashup for you of legal podcasts because we have our old friend and oft-time TWiL panelist Ernie Svensson joining us from TWiL. Ernie, thanks for coming back on the show.
Great to be here as always. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yes, it is. And the mashup component is we have two of the crew from Technically Legal, Ben Snitkoff. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's great to be on the show.
Great to have you. And David O'Brien is joining us once again. Hi, David. Great to have you back.
Hello, and it's great to be back.
Wonderful. Ernie, I'm so glad that you've recovered from Super Bowl festivities and were able to make it down to the office today.
I didn't make it down to the office. I'm still at home.
Oh, you're still at home. All right, the home office. Yes. Well, you know, that's partially.
That's I made it down the hall. There.
Good, good. So you managed to enjoy the rest of the festivities without further Super Bowl-related legal complications?
I did. It was a lot of fun. You know, we've been in a state of complete euphoria. I have the NFL Network on at all times just in case they play replays. It's really funny. If you go to any sports bar or any kind of bar in New Orleans, like I was down the French Quarter having a po' boy with my brother after the game, and they played a replay of the interception, and the whole crowd just stops what they're doing, starts chanting, going into the Who Dat chant as though they had seen this for the first time. You know, it's very strange.
Well, it was really fun to watch from all around and know how much fun you were having. So that was own little personal tie to the Super Bowl this year.
Well, everybody who wants to have fun, just come on down. We do this all the time.
Great. Well, one thing that I want to jump right into here and get going with is the new service from Google, Google Buzz, which they just connected up to Gmail maybe yesterday or the day before. So it's super new. We're recording this on Friday the 12th. Oh, and just from before we launch into the substantive discussions, you can watch the show live Fridays at 11 o'clock at live.twit.tv, where we're streaming right now. And you can also check in before the show and give us your thoughts on some of the things we're going to discuss at our Facebook page, which is denise.howell.net/FB. And the thing I want to jump into here is this Buzz service, which reminds me a lot of some of the things that Facebook has stumbled on over the years, because they went ahead and activated this for all Gmail users. Now, I don't know anything about the number of Gmail users, but I'm assuming it's a really big number. So it got switched on without Google going through its typical, okay, we're going to release this to just a few users and have a beta trial period and maybe have invites and, you know, sort of test things out before launching it to a wide audience. This time it just got sort of bolted onto Gmail and is live and going. And when I first saw it, I thought, okay, this is interesting, but was a little bit concerned about the way it was munging up people's email context with their social public web presence context. And sure enough, over just the last couple of days that it's been live, I have kind of a triple threat of pieces for people to check out in the show notes, which you can find at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/47. The first is a post by Phil Lenson where he's going, you know, I just don't know about splitting up your life this way. I just don't know if your Gmail people are the people that you're going to want to be having Twitter-like, Facebook-like interactions with. So he had some early trepidation. And then over at ZDNet, Jason Perlow has a post called What the Buzz? Get Me Off This Crazy Thing, where he goes on to detail his sort of nightmarish experience where he was following Jason Calacanis and could not, for the life of him, figure out a way to turn off a Jason Calacanis-related buzz that kept showing up in his stream. And finally, his wife yells at him from the other room, who's this Calacanis guy? Because they were connected, and friends of friends apparently pop up in your buzz stream. So you can see where this is going. The last thing to check out then is a post by a blogger named Harriet Jacobs. She has a blog called Fugitivist. That says F you Google, and goes on to detail how the defaults in Buzz wound up having her, unbeknownst to her, sharing her Google Reader shared items with her ex, who she apparently is quite afraid of. And so there's this whole nightmare scenario where she has information that is locationally based and otherwise personal and private that is getting shared out with people that she 100% does not want this information going to. And there's no way for her to turn it off because she has no Google profile. And the lack of a Google profile means that you have some issues in controlling how Buzz works. So we go through the whole process and we can see that there are some assumptions about people's defaults that are being made here that probably should have been tweaked before this service was unleashed to the world. Have you guys played around with it? And what are your thoughts on the privacy issues? Ben?
I used Buzz for just about 24 hours. I turned it on. I honestly didn't like it a lot. I had some, initially it sounded kind of interesting, but after that I was basically getting repeats of everything that I saw in, you know, my friend's Google Reader shared streams and on Twitter. A lot of people had linked up their Twitter accounts. So at that point, I was wondering what the point was. As to the privacy issues, I mean, this is something that just keeps on happening and happening. And I'm wondering how long it's going to be before companies realize that you either have to inform people how this is going to go, you know, what's going to happen when they sign up for these, or, you know, is there going to be some sort of requirement that the companies have a click-through for the privacy in addition to saying, you know, we own everything that you post on this, these are what the privacy concerns are going to be. I don't know if I'd like to see a legislative solution for these privacy questions, but it would be interesting to see if anyone ever comes out with one or even proposes one that says, before we share your data with all of these people, some of whom you know, some of whom you don't, you have to, you know, click through and say, yes, I understand that this is how my data is going to be used.
Right. It really is disturbing to me because it's not the the first time Google has encountered a problem really similar to this. There was a bit of an uproar about its Google Reader settings maybe a year and a half ago, when all of a sudden you were able to comment on and have more social features within Google Reader. One of the things that happened there were your Gmail contacts came in and were people you were connected to on Google Reader. So again, it's an instance of Google assuming that the people that you have interactions with in email are who, that has something to do with your social graph and is predictive of who you're going to want to share various private or personal bits of data with. And you know, the person who's emailing with her ex obviously is a great example of how that's not necessarily the case. Ernie, have you kicked the tires on this thing at all?
Yeah, I turned it on. I turned it on after I saw first a wave of people saying, oh, this is really great and new. And then I saw a wave of people saying it had some problems. So I had already seen the euphoria and the disappointment. And, when I turned it on, my first reaction was, well, it looks a lot like Google Reader. And why do I really want this? You know, I have enough trouble managing all of the information streams that I have right now. But I'm willing to give it a shot. So as to me privately, I haven't really made up my mind as to whether it's useful or not. But on the larger issue that we're talking about, I totally agree with Ben, that this keeps happening and happening and happening, and nobody seems to learn from the mistake. And, I say the mistake. I'm not sure that we all agree on what the mistake is. To me, the mistake is assuming that people are not going to be jolted when suddenly they find this major shift in their information stream, so that, it's not just going to their true friends, but to other people that they didn't know about. I think to the people who flip these switches and turn it on, the mistake is something else, because I think they're driven to push us along. A lot of people don't even know anything about the online world, and they're just these are the kind of things that make them go bonkers. I mean, this is why you get weird rulings and weird ideas from institutions like the Florida Bar saying judges can't friend lawyers on Facebook. I mean, because nobody knows what the hell's going on, but they hear a lot of bad things are happening, and everybody kind of gets that a lot of these bad things that are happening really shouldn't happen. I mean, it's just really strange. I don't, I guess it's just Google wants to, keep pushing the envelope and, be in that space where Twitter and other people are, and they're in such a hurry to get there that they just fail to take certain things into account. Because I just can't believe that if they had tested this, they wouldn't have, anticipated the problem that Fugitivist talks about, where her ex-husband is suddenly meshed in with other people. I mean, that's just bizarre.
Yeah. David, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, I really didn't get a chance to check it out too much. I actually did click into it for about 5 seconds, but that was it. First of all, I probably, like all of you, get hundreds of emails a week to my Gmail account. And each time that I get an email in, at some point that contact that's emailing me is getting saved into my contact settings. And so, I would be especially concerned about what would be published then, or what kinds of information I would be receiving from all those people on my contact list. Sort of the more troubling thing is that it's kind of similar to what Facebook is seemingly doing when they're opening up all these new privacy holes, basically, and they're allowing people to connect in new and different ways. If you're already a registered user, you've already agreed to the terms of service. And within those terms of service, there's usually some sort of privacy terms that govern the usage of all your private, personally identifiable information. And so if you're already a registered Google user and you click into Buzz just to check it out or whatever, you've already agreed to all those terms, and that information is getting out to everybody. But it's not like you had a choice really beforehand to really consider the privacy implications of what it really means to join the Google Buzz.
Right. The thing that cracked me up about this is that, it's not like companies haven't already tripped over this in the past. Facebook coming to mind most prevalently. And here, Google's just going ahead and making some really broad sweeping assumptions about what it means to have an email relationship with somebody. And sure, it might well mean that you are very personally and closely connected to them, but it might well mean just the opposite, and here they are forging into the enterprise space with the Google Apps email products, Gmail that can work for your domain, et cetera, and I assume they're going to hook Buzz up to that before too long. So there you're not only munging together somebody's universe of personal email contacts, but then their business email contacts too. And I think it reminds me just of when I was little, I used to watch The Odd Couple with my parents, and there was a great scene where Felix Unger was representing himself in court, and he had a flip chart and a pen. He was making his closing argument to the jury, and he wrote the word assume and said, never assume, because when you assume, you make an ass out of you and me. And he circled those parts of the word. And I think that here the Felix Unger rule definitely applies, and they should have at minimum tested this thing in a broader sandbox than just the Google universe before they went ahead and rolled it out to the whole Gmail community. Because right now I think they're facing the backlash, and you know, they could potentially be facing a lawsuit, much like Facebook did with Beacon. And that's something else that got resolved or was in the news this week. Did you guys see that the Beacon lawsuit settled?
Yep.
Or is in the process?
Yes, so I saw that.
Here we go. So we have another company that that made some assumptions about what it would be okay for users to share with one another. In that case, the history of their purchases and things that they connected to their Facebook accounts. I remember I saw somebody had purchased Fandango tickets when Beacon was functioning way back in the day. And I was wondering why my Facebook friend was telling me this. And sure enough, it's because Beacon was rolled out to, you know, sort of merge social and commercial interactions. And there was a class action lawsuit pending that just recently settled for $9.5 million. And Facebook is also agreeing to seed a digital trust fund that would issue more than $6 million in grants to organizations studying privacy. Are you guys surprised that this settled? Ben, what do you think?
I'm not really surprised that it settled at all. It seemed like it was a pretty clear violation of the Video Privacy and Protection Act, which protects the information regarding what videotapes you rent. And one of the things that Beacon did was it tied into, I believe it was Blockbuster. So when somebody rented a video on Blockbuster, on Blockbuster's analog to Netflix, what would happen is once you rented the video on Blockbuster, you'd get a little pop-up on your that says, do you want to share this with Facebook? Facebook claimed that if you ignored it or clicked no, it wouldn't share. A lot of people claimed that they just never saw it. And as a result, that got shared with everyone on Facebook, which was a pretty clear violation of the act and results in, I think it's about $2,500 worth of damages. So, you know, Facebook maintains, and as a result of settling, they get to maintain that, you know, they did nothing wrong, that there's no wrongdoing in the suit, and they're just settling to, you know, make it go away. But it, at least in my view of the law, there are some pretty clear violations that, you know, once this lawsuit got as far as it did, they probably weren't going to win. Or if it did, it would have cost so much that it just wouldn't be worth trying to litigate it through.
David, you and Ben too, right? Do some work with the Citizen Media Law Project. Ben, are you involved with them too?
I'm not. That's just David.
That's just David. Okay, David. So this seems like a great big issue. This you know, is it opt in or opt out type issue? And I think that was the case with Beacon and also with this new Buzz service from Google. Do you see anything on the horizon that could assist with this legislatively or otherwise?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, certainly as more and more people become aware of the concerns about a program that just instantly opts you in and you have to go and find the setting to opt out of it, you know, as more people become aware of that, I think it's going to become a bigger issue in the future. And we've heard Mark Zuckerberg talk in the past, and based on what we're seeing from Google this week, I might be thinking along that they're thinking along the same lines that Mark Zuckerberg was, that these two huge companies are really changing the way that we think about privacy. And they're both immensely popular. A lot of people use the Gmail services, just as a lot of people use Facebook. And so maybe they're thinking that they can sort of affect the way that, you know, the privacy law is going to go into the future.
Ernie, do you think that this privacy foundation that Facebook is setting up is going to help or hurt matters?
I think it's a PR move, you know, and that's fine for them. You know, I don't think it really means anything. I mean, we'll see if it means anything down the road. I think the problem is there's so much change going on at one time, you know, and we're talking about changing social expectations. And I think that that's where you get this notion, which I guess I've heard Zuckerberg put forth, that, you know, the newer generation sees things differently. So this is okay. And that it may be true that the younger generation sees things differently, but, you know, Facebook is more than the younger generation. It's got, you know, 150 million users or whatever. Gmail, you know, has, I think, similar numbers. And so when you start manipulating the system that all of these 150 million people connect into without giving them any advance notice, you're going to have a problem. And the problem is going to be backlash. The problem is probably also going to be litigation. I'm not in favor of legislation. I don't think that the legislation could ever keep up with, you know, this fast and moving target. But there doesn't have to be legislation. There'll be lawsuits. And the lawsuits, you know, will have their own PR, and they'll have their own movement, and you know, the companies will have to deal with lawsuits. And maybe they just look at it like the lawsuits are no big deal. I mean, $9 million to Facebook, you know, may not be a big deal, but they're going to get more of these lawsuits if they keep behaving in this way. That's my prediction.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you know, I'm not asserting that there's anything legally wrong with what Buzz did, but I do think that by making the assumptions it has, it's thwarting user expectations, and that they could definitely be more considerate of those expectations and user privacy concerns by making things opt in rather than opt out. We were just talking last week about Google recognizing International Data Privacy Day and putting its privacy statements and policies online and highlighting them in a simplified kind of way so that people could check them out and see that they're wearing a white hat when it comes to that kind of thing. But, you know, they do something like this and it really makes you wonder. Just as a side note with this, another thing that happened, and our sister show here on Twit is going to have a fun week, I think, this week between Buzz launching and also there was news that Google purchased a company called Aardvark, which is sort of a help your friends kind of network. The Aardvark got bought by Google for $50 million. And I can definitely see that connecting in with this Buzz service. The way that Aardvark works, if you haven't used it, is you give Aardvark a little bit of information about things that you know about, like I might say law and parenting and, you know, a few other things, skateboarding maybe, from a beginner standpoint. Anyway, they file that away somewhere. And then as people put questions into the system, you can fine-tune, you know, how often you get pinged by other users. But someone who has a concern or a question can send that your way. And if you want to, you can answer them. So it's a nice little service. I've definitely used it both on the answering side and the asking side. And I can see how Google might want to bolt it on to some kind of social infrastructure. But still, you know, it feels like there's an awful lot going on here, and I don't mean to be slow to embrace change, but I have my doubts and hesitations about them. Ben, have you tried Aardvark, and have you found it useful?
I actually haven't. The first I heard about it, embarrassingly, was yesterday when the story broke that Google was buying it. I was wondering, though, is it anonymous? When you submit a question, and well, rather, when you respond to a question, does the user who asked the question get any information about you other than the answer?
You know, it's been a while since I set up my profile there. The emails, I think, get routed through the system, so you're not sharing your email address with anybody. And I think it's up to you, you know, how much information you want to share about yourself on your profile, that you could have a, you know, a pseudonym or anonymous kind of identity there, or you can be yourself. But your username, that kind of thing, gets shared with the person that you're answering. David, have you ever checked it out?
No, this would be another new service to me as well. Mm-hmm. It looks kind of interesting, though. I mean, I got to be honest, though. At some point, like, I just get super saturated with social interaction on the internet. And it seems like every month we hear about another new service which pops up, which offers some new angle on how to interact with people. So it'd be interesting to see what happens with this, you know, from a business standpoint.
Yep, it sure will. Well, Google, good luck with Buzz. I really wish you had given it. You know, it would have been nice if they'd treated it the way they'd treated Wave. And I saw that Steve Rubell actually likened it to Wave Lite. And it is a little bit like that, just in the way that it, you know, enables you to have a threaded discussion. Also in the fact that it's slow to load, at least on my machine. So I can definitely see that they're trying to take the features that make Wave nice and bring it to their large universe of Gmail users. But, you know, if they had done it the way they did Wave, where they rolled it out slowly and it was an invite process and there was already kind of a community that was there by the time most people joined, that I think would have been helpful. So anyway, let's go on to some of our other stories here today. David, I think this was you that went ahead and tagged this on Twitter. It was a Wall Street Journal law blog story about cell phone tracking.
Actually, that was Ben.
Ben, you want to bring us up to speed on that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So the U.S. government has had a process in place for several years now where when they wanted information, specifically historic information about where you've been, what they would do is they would go to a federal court and they'd ask a judge there to order the cell phone company, or they'd figure out what your cell phone number was, and then they'd get an order to tell the cell phone company to hand over all of those historic records that were generated. So every 7 seconds, your cell phone company will send a ping from a tracking tower to your cell phone, and then it bounces back. And from that information, they can figure out what cell phone tower is nearest to you so that when a call comes in or when you dial out, well, when a call comes in, they can route the call to the nearest cell tower and then get that out to you. And as a result of this, they have a log of whenever your phone is on, every 7 seconds, where you are. And this, how close they can get ranges from about a 3-mile radius in really rural areas to as close as 200 or even 50 feet in dense urban areas where there are a lot of cell towers. So they have this stored information, and they've got it going back a long time. And the government would go into a court and ask the court under something called the Stored Communications Act to hand out this information. And I'm going to have to shuffle my papers here for a second. What was interesting is that under the Stored Communication Act, the government thought that they'd be able to get this information based on a reasonable belief that the information was relevant to a criminal investigation, as opposed to when they need a warrant, where they need to show probable cause that that information is relevant to produce information about a crime that's already happened or a crime that's going to happen. And as a result of that, you know, you have this lowered threshold that the government has to show in order to get all sorts of information, you know, exactly where you are. It could show essentially, and this is one of the things that a court mentioned, is that from this information, they'll be able to tell where you live, where you work, what church you go to, things that implicate, you know, your freedom of your privacy interest, where you live, that implicate your freedom of association, where you, you know, go to meetings, where you go to church. And most of the judges who've come by these orders, and my understanding is that it was practiced for a long time just to, you know, issue the to try to get these orders using the lower standard. Most of the judges would just rubber stamp them. And a magistrate judge in Philadelphia would at one point just said, you know what? No, I don't think you guys can do this under that. And the magistrate judge denied the order. And as a result, the government's appealed that. And sometime today, in fact, the argument was probably this morning, the government is going to argue in front of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia saying, you know, we should be able to get this information under the lower standard, under this easier standard, where all we have to do to get this historic data is prove that, you know, we've got an articulable reason. You know, we can just give you, we can say that, you know, we've got a reason why you should give this information to us because it's pertinent to an ongoing investigation.
Right, but they don't have to say anything about the substance of that investigation or otherwise satisfy a reasonable search and seizure kind of standard under the Fourth Amendment?
From the best that I can tell, no. And the government was very happy with that, but the judge was not. The magistrate judge who initially denied the order said a couple of things. First of all, the Stored Communications Act doesn't apply to mobile tracking devices. And the judge said, you know, essentially what you're saying is what you guys are saying is we want to use these mobile tracking devices in everybody's pocket to track them. And as a result, you know, the judge said, well, the Stored Communications Act doesn't apply to tracking devices. So you can't use this lower standard in the Stored Communications Act to do that. And then the judge went on and said, and because there's, you know, the privacy interests involved are so great for people that, you know, they have a reasonable expectation to believe that they're not going to be tracked by the government at every turn. The government is going to have to get a warrant to get these orders. Mm-hmm. To get the tracking data from the cell phone companies.
Right. So what's the solution here? Or is there one?
The solution is to cross our fingers and hope that the Third Circuit Court of Appeals agrees with the magistrate judge and then the district court judge who affirmed the magistrate judge. There's a weird system. Magistrate judges in the federal system are just below, you know, your standard district court judge. The district court judges are the people who hear trials. Magistrate judges will often hear motions before the trial to try to break up the load. So if a magistrate judge, you know, hands down an opinion, it goes to the district court judge and then the district court judge to the appeals court. And then the appeals court, you can petition after the appeals court, you can petition to the Supreme Court to get review of the case.
Right. Ernie, what do you think about the government having access to all this information?
Well, I'm concerned about it. And I think that this is the sort of thing that when Scott McNeely said, you know, privacy is dead, get over it, he was talking about. I think we were when all of this, flow of information was starting up and the internet was a big deal in the beginning, I think this is what we were all worried about. We thought, you know, it would be the government using our data against us. And that is a concern, but I you know, since we talked about the other thing earlier, I think there's an interesting difference between the two, because the real problem, the one that people keep running into where their information actually is being used in ways they don't like, is with the Facebook situation and the Google situation. Here, you know, you have the threat that it's going to be used, and we, you know, and if you're really paranoid, then you really don't like this, and if you're just mildly paranoid, you don't like it. But it's not really clear how this is going to be used improperly. I'm sure it will be, but you know, we tend not to know about it because it's not like the government uses this and then posts it, you know, in their Google Reader feed or anything like that. I think this is an area where there should be legislation, where we should have a debate, a national debate about what it is that we want the government to be able to do with these types of information. And I think that is the kind of debate that can happen and should happen at the national level. And it will be interesting to see, you know, who rises up against stuff like this. I mean, a lot of people who want to carry firearms and think that that's their right in case the government does anything strange don't seem to be rising up and complaining about this. Would they if they knew more about it? You know, I don't know. But I think that's where we should have this conversation.
Yep. David, do you see any light at the end of the tunnel for geolocationally tied information and how the government accesses it and uses it?
Well, I was really always concerned about being kidnapped in my sleep and having some sort of implant put in my head. So I made a series of tinfoil hats, which I keep handy just in case I need to worry about information being transmitted from my head. But it turns out the device was actually on my hip the whole time in my BlackBerry holster. It's pretty concerning, actually. I mean, if you think about it, you know, these standards do exist for a reason. And the standards for probable cause in order to get search warrants also exist for a reason. And these are important things that people should be concerned about. And having the ability to go in and get that type of data under a less strict standard is just there's so many problems with that and how that could be abused. And I think in the past, we've seen numerous scenarios where people in the government have abused those methods of obtaining information. And so something certainly needs to be done about it. And, you know, I don't know if that if this is really going to arise to the occasion of some sort of legislative action where definitions are made more clear, or if people at least have some sort of clear understanding about how their data on cell phones is going to be used. I mean, we're talking about devices that everybody has in the country. You know, I know a ton of people that don't even use landlines anymore. That's where our generation is. But now, do we really want ourselves to be tracked everywhere with geolocation tools? I don't know. You know, and maybe something along the lines of an opt-in, opt-out kind of thing, and maybe having some sort of special circumstances for criminal investigations where you still have to establish the standards for probable cause and file all your subpoenas correctly in order to get that type of data. Those, you know, that seems to be at least a partial solution. You know, I think we need to have more conversations about it. We need to understand how it's going to be used, how people are going to go about getting the data itself, and on top of all of that, how the cell phone companies are going to be handling your data as well.
One thing that I'd love to see is, you know, some sort of system where I could choose what, you know, with my cell phone company, or choose rather even a cell phone carrier that just didn't store this information. A cell phone carrier that, you know, they had, you know, a network, or even a virtual mobile network operator, somebody who was, you know, piggybacking on somebody else's network, who would just dump the data after a day and it wouldn't be available. And that's the kind of thing that even I'd love to see for a home internet, you know, some a home internet company that would just not log the data, you know, not log IP addresses, not store that kind of information. And that, I think, would just be a fantastic kind of competitive solution to this kind of thing. And I mean, I'd prefer if the government wasn't trying to get this with less than probable cause. But as far as other solutions, and that to me would be almost ideal.
Aren't there data retention regulations that might run afoul of? I mean, aren't companies almost required, or isn't there even pending legislation where there are certain requirements that they have to meet as far as, you know, the balance between tossing it out immediately and keeping it forever?
There may be. If there is, I'm not really familiar with it.
Yeah, I'm not 100% either, but it strikes me that that if a company were to do this, it to be, you know, sort of the hush mail for internet access or cell phone transactions, that they might face that kind of hurdle. But I'm not quite sure, you know, exactly regulatory wise where they would stumble. Okay, so let's move on here. I know that over on Technically Legal, because I've been listening to the show, which folks can find at technicallylegal.org, in addition to moving seamlessly between talks of homemade apple pie and how to make one, and robot.txt files, which, of course, you know, anybody who can move between those sorts of topics is near and dear to our hearts here at Twill. You guys have been looking at the Google Books settlement as well. And I guess that there was just a development on that where the DOJ came out and said, you know what, we just don't like the revised settlement either, in addition to all the other people who have said so. Do you think that that's a nail in the coffin of the settlement and things are going to have to start over? Or where do we stand with all this? Ben, do you know?
As far as this goes, the DOJ not approving of it is as close to a nail in the coffin as there's going to be. I mean, mm-hmm. in the end, this is in the hands of the parties to the case, whether or not they agree on it, and the judge, and whether or not the judge approves of it. But I think any federal judge would be very reluctant to approve the settlement in this class action without the approval of the DOJ.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, David? Do you think that this thing has a prayer of going forward in its current form, or what will the parties do now?
I don't know. This case is just, I mean, the settlement has just been such a mouthful for like the last several years. It's just too hard to say where it's going to go. And certainly the fact that the DOJ has taken a look at it and they're indicating that they believe it's likely to be illegal is certainly a good indication of their thoughts on it. And like Ben noted, that's definitely going to influence the judge's you know, the judge's decision when he's faced with ultimately, you know, accepting the settlement offer between the parties. And we still have all these issues that are sort of left open between all of the different parties that are involved in the case itself. And there, you know, there are a lot of good reasons for why I think Google is interested in using it, this service, in order to scan the books. And it, you know, it's great because I don't think anyone else wants to do it, nor do they really have the resources to do it. But at the same time, it, you know, it's raising all these copyright concerns with people are concerned about how their works are going to be used, how much of their works are going to be used, who's going to be paid, and what are the licensing terms that Google is actually going to be using when they provide the books online. So, you know, like I am still reluctant to make speculations based on this suit, just because of like how contentious it's been in the past.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting that the Authors Guild itself, in a post over on its site earlier in the month, said that one of the reasons that it wanted to have some sort of settlement go forward, and the one that they have on the table is the one that's operative at the moment, is that they were conscious of what had happened to the RIAA, and that the lawsuits that the RIAA had pursued hadn't dented the legal pirated music, the illegal pirated music marketplace. Here's their quote: "Our settlement negotiations went on with full knowledge of what happened to the music industry. The RIAA won victory after victory, defeating Napster and Grokster with groundbreaking legal rulings. The RIAA also went after countless individuals, chasing down infringement wherever they could track it down, but it didn't work. The infringement just moved elsewhere in unpredictable ways." So, you know, I mean, at least the rights holder side of this equation seems to be conscious of the fact that in order to move things forward, they're going to have to find a way to give access to the information that the Google Books settlement is all about, the text of books in digital form. Ernie, any thoughts about this big mess of a settlement and what might happen next?
Yeah, the weird thing here is that you have these orphan works, which, you know, at first glance, I guess, would seem to be like, oh, this is the easiest thing to deal with. Well, somebody needs to have rights to this, and we need to figure out how to do it. So I think that's what Google claims to be trying to do, or was trying to do. But a class action is just a weird procedural vehicle to attempt to accomplish this. But we've gotten so used to class actions that, you know, we just assume that anything can be a class action. But what you're doing in a class action like this is you're going to adjudicate the rights of people who aren't at all present in this suit, the orphan works rights holders. And you know, I mean, even if it's the best thing for right now that Google or somebody has, you know, the ability to negotiate this, why should Google wind up with the monopoly control over these orphan rights just because they happen to be involved in this lawsuit and used the class action in this novel way? I mean, I have a problem with that. I have a problem with the procedure. You know, I can even assume, you know, that Google is acting in the best interest. It doesn't even matter to me. It's just too bizarre, this method by which they're proceeding. And I think that now that the U.S. attorney has raised that question, I don't think the settlement's going to go through because it's just too bizarre. I mean, you know, if nobody had said anything about it, then we could treat it like, well, it was just Google and the Authors Guild reaching the settlement. But really, they're reaching the settlement, adjudicating the rights of people who aren't there. And I think once that red flag was raised, this thing is dead because I don't really see a way to fix it.
Well, it's so funny to me because, I mean, we've already had the settlement on the table once and it was withdrawn to deal with all the criticism. Here it is again, getting ripped to shreds one more time. These parties don't want to go to trial, but it seems like, you know, they're being pushed in that direction. I hope they can actually find a way to craft a settlement document that will withstand all the criticism and heat and actually help them avoid a trial. It seems like you know, they're trying their best to to do that, but they're actually getting pushed in that direction. So we'll just have to see what happens. It's fairly interesting. Okay, so let's see here. Speaking of the RIAA, the Jamie Thomas case, we have talked about before on the show and how the damages in that case were knocked down on remittitor by the judge. What's going to happen next with that, Ben? We had a development on that this week.
Right. The RIAA said that they don't want any part of this remittitor. They opted. So what happened is the judge said these damages in the case were way, way too excessive, and he knocked them down to $54,000. And he said the RIAA's options are either accept the $54,000 or, in the alternative, get a new trial. But and in this case, the RIAA, well, first they offered Jamie Thomas, I think it was a settlement for about $25,000, which she declined. And then the RIAA in return said, well, in that case, we're going to opt for the third trial. And that's where we are now. I don't think anything's been scheduled at this point. But on the current track, this is going to go for a third trial. But this time, it's only going to be on the issue of damages. And I don't want to take credit for this thought because it wasn't mine. I think it was a copyright blog, and the name of which is eluding me right now. But they said, what's this new trial going to look like? Because in the judge's last opinion in this case, where he knocked down the damages, he said the most that a reasonable jury could have awarded in this case was the $54,000. So is the judge going to give an instruction saying, by the way, the most you can award in this case is $54,000? Because if he doesn't, it just looks like if he doesn't give that instruction and the jury comes back for more than that, it looks like they're just – the judge is just going to come back and say, well, we're going to knock it down again because I've said previously that the most any reasonable jury could award is $54,000.
Oh,
I think this is really interesting because it's still a little bit unclear whether or not the judge even had the authority to knock down the statutory damages on remittitor. And I think Ben Scheffner the other week had commented about this. And, I mean, you have a statutory damages provision in the Copyright Act. It specifies that these are the range of damages for the jury to consider after you found somebody guilty of copyright infringement. And the jury in that case assigned an amount of damages, and then you had the actual damages award come down. And then you have this judge stepping in saying, well, you know what, I don't think the jury was really right here, even though the Copyright Act says that it's between these two amounts at $750,000 and $150,000, I think. So I don't know if you guys had any thoughts about whether or not that was likely to be challenged in the future, probably after this third trial for damages.
Yeah, I think that would certainly be challenged.
That would be challenged on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what happens is if there's a third trial. See, I don't think that the trial judge would say if there is a third trial, you're limited to $54,000 because. That question that Dave was just talking about hasn't really been litigated, whether the judge could even do that. And there's probably going to have to be an appeal about that. Otherwise, why waste time having a third trial? Because the Court of Appeals may say, no, that was perfectly okay.
Right. I definitely think that this question of whether you can reduce within a range that is authorized by statute is a novel one and hasn't been tested out before. And assuming that it plays any role in the final award of damages in this case, then we'll definitely see that taken up on appeal. The other interesting thing that I wanted to talk about from a courtroom standpoint today was, did you see that... It was Bob Caulfield who sent this our way. There was a jury instruction given in a case related to social media use by jurors, warning them about the use of electronic technology and social media, presumably when they are deliberating on a case. And this is a proposed model jury instruction from the Judicial Conference Committee on Court Administration and Case Management. And it goes on to tell them, you know, it sort of mirrors what you're used to seeing jurors get as far as shielding themselves from media exposure about the case. But here it goes ahead and warns them about what they can do with their electronic devices or media, such as a telephone, cell phone, smartphone, iPhone, BlackBerry, or computer, the internet, any internet service, or any text or instant messaging service, any internet chat room, blog, or website, such as Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, YouTube, Twitter, to communicate any information about this case or to conduct any research about this case until I accept your verdict, the judge would instruct them. Ernie, you're in the courtroom frequently. Can you see this jury instruction getting trotted out, and what do you think its impact will be?
Well, I think this jury instruction has been trotted out. I have a couple of friends who are federal judges, and whenever I see these little blurbs about social media being used by jurors, I'll forward the news article to them. And invariably, they tell me, oh, yeah, we know all about this. We've had proposed jury instructions. We've been using them for a while, and I guess that this would be the ones that they would be using. And what I find interesting, I clerked for 2 years for a federal judge, and you know, he would go talk to the jurors after a trial, and we got to, you know, I would go into the room to bring them coffee. And so, I mean, I had access to the jurors when they were doing their thing. And I often think about it, how different it is now, because, you know, the courtroom, you know, in those days, they were truly sequestered. Now, they got to go home at night if it was a multi-day trial. But, you know, while they were in that room, in those days, there weren't cell phones. You know, there was just no way for them to get any information other than what they heard. Now, when they went home, if it was on TV, they could watch TV. But there wasn't the internet. There was no way for them to actively search. Now, it's just so pervasive. I mean, you can give an instruction like this, but I don't know that people are actually going to follow it. I think that what it will accomplish is it will prevent jurors from all sitting around and surfing the web and then collectively sharing that information or talking about it. Because since the judge told them they can't do it, they're not going to acknowledge that to one another. But I mean, if I'm checking my smartphone, who's to say whether I'm just checking email or whether I'm checking Twitter or whether I'm actively searching for information? And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, 20 years from now, that's the norm. So they can prohibit it, but I think people are going to still do it.
David, what do you think about jury instructions like this? Do they have any impact, or are they just sort of trying to give guidelines? What do you think?
Well, we have seen a number of cases fairly recently, actually, in the last 6 months, where trials have been thrown out after it was determined that jury members had friended each other on Facebook or, you know, connected somehow out of the courtroom online, or sometimes they were doing research on Wikipedia. And certainly it's a huge concern, for at least for the attorneys trying the case and potentially the judge too, because, you know, you want to have sort of this appearance of no impropriety whatsoever as it goes on in the jury room. And, you know, I don't know what the effect is going to be. You know, I think Ernie might be right when he says that, you know, it's probably not going to affect the way that people go about these days listening to a case as they sit on the jury, and then what happens when they go home and they turn on the TV, and now it's might not be the TV, it's probably the internet, and they're going to see, if it's a trial that's attracted a lot of public attention, they're going to see blog posts on it. They might see other types of news stories that come out of like the New York Times or wherever, and, you know, opinion pieces offering some sort of insight perhaps into the case. At the very least, the other thing too is that I don't really know that this is terribly new. I think that judges have been aware of this problem, again, like Ernie mentioned, and they've been giving instructions to the contrary for jury members not to contact each other outside of the courtroom. And so the fact that we now have these suggested jury instructions coming out of this conference, it doesn't really strike me as very new. I mean, I think at the very least, the one good thing that it does is it sort of outlines exactly what you want to say as a judge to the jury. But any of you, if you've ever sat through a trial and you get to the end right before the jury is given leave to deliberate, there is a serious amount of instructions that are given to the jury. And I mean, you could sit there for 30 minutes sometimes, and the judge is just going over all the rules about how they deliberate. And so there's already a serious amount of thought that goes into those jury instructions. There's usually input from the parties who are trying the case. And so I would be really, really surprised if most federal judges these days are not aware of these issues, and that some that you know that doesn't somehow come into the instructions that they actually give to jury members.
Yeah, it's a huge burden to sit on a jury. You know, you're compensated very little. It's nominal at best, and your time away from your job or your family, the jury pool that's left to and able to participate in trials is so slim to begin with, and then to begin to curtail their use of these devices that are so important to their lives. It's just sort of adding insult to injury. Ben, any thoughts on this before we move on?
I'm largely just going to echo what other people said. You know, there's nothing particularly new in this jury instruction in that the jurors were always prohibited from doing outside research about what was going on. I guess that's really what I have to say. So it's not new in how much they're and that they can't do research. It's just emphasizing that they can't do research on their iPhones, on their Blackberries. They can't talk about the case, not only with their loved ones, which is another instruction that they'll get, but you know they also can't talk about it on any social networking. And as for your point, Denise, that people may take away from it that they're not allowed to use their phones at all. And that was pretty much always the case. Jurors have been kicked off juries for, doing crosswords while they're supposed to be paying attention to the evidence. So as far as that goes, they're certainly supposed to be paying attention during, evidence and, when they take breaks. I think they're still allowed to use their iPhone.
I wasn't suggesting that they'd be sitting there texting from the courtroom, but, I've been in courtrooms before where, no one was allowed to bring electronic devices in of any kind. Now, I don't think that's necessarily the norm, but I think it varies from court to court how much you're able to actually bring connections to the outside world into the courtroom with you. But then when you leave the courtroom as a juror, obviously there's to the extent they're being asked to continue to check their BlackBerry at the door, as it were. I think that would be just something that would be ignored. And yet again, we're left with this situation where it could impact the fairness of the jury's result and the ability of their verdict to withstand challenge. So here's something that is new, if this jury instruction itself is sort of an echo of what courts have been struggling with for a long time. What courts haven't necessarily been struggling with is what will happen to them if the Supreme Court has banned video streaming or reporting of what's going on in the courtroom, as happened in the Prop 8 trial in California. We've talked about that on the show before, how the court had initially decided that it was going to put this Proposition 8 gay marriage trial on YouTube, the video from that on YouTube from the courtroom. The Supreme Court came in at the 11th hour and said, no, you're not going to be able to do that. But there are a couple of filmmakers who have gone ahead and circumvented that Supreme Court ruling by doing what I guess I've seen similar things on court TV in the past. They're going to do a dramatic reenactment of what's gone on in the courtroom by using transcripts, information from bloggers and professional actors to go ahead and create a courtroom experience on YouTube. Ernie, what do you think about this little end run?
Well, I don't think it's technically a circumvention, although I don't really know exactly what the court's ruling says, but it's more akin to, these reenactments that you see on the crime drama, story where they explain what happened and they use actors. And, it's clever. I'm sure it's going to get some attention, but I don't think it's really a circumvention. I do think that the Supreme Court's view that, there shouldn't be video in the courtroom is wrong. And I think that it's one of those things that is just going to erode over time. It's just a question of how long will it take before there are cameras in the courtroom. This is an area where we focus on the OJ case and, you know, all the hoopla that happened there and all that, the stupid things that happened there. And we say, well, we don't want that to happen again. Well, I mean, the OJ case was sui generis. It wasn't, you know, I mean, you could use the OJ case to teach an entire law school curriculum, 3 years worth of stuff. Every legal issue was packed into that. That shouldn't be used as a metric. But there should be transparency about what happens in courts, with the exceptions that are appropriate, such as children testifying, you know, certain situations, fine. You don't have, you know, broadcast there. But a normal day in court, all of that should be on video. It should be. I mean, it's crazy. And I think, you know, when people talk about needing to have trust in their governmental institutions, I just find it bizarre that the Supreme Court hasn't caught up to this. Now, I do know why. I do know why, because I clerked for a federal judge and I know lots of federal judges, and they just have this fear that there will be a circus. They have the fear of the tinfoil hat wearing people coming out. They have a fear of people knowing who they are. I mean, for example, I'm involved in an Inn of Court, and we decided to use Meetup as a way to manage our membership, which was really great. But the judges said, well, we don't know if we can put our pictures up there because the marshal's office tells us that we're not allowed to put our pictures, you know, on the internet. I mean, come on. You know, like you couldn't find out what they look like by Googling, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. But that's the mindset of the average, and I'll say the federal judge, but it's the mindset of the marshal's office, which tells the judges how they should be concerned about security. And it's just, it's ridiculous. So, you know, great that they're going to have a reenactment, but I don't think that's a circumvention. I wish there were a way to circumvent it. And I think over time, there is going to be, because people are just going to do it. They're going to Twitter from inside courtrooms. They're going to find ways to give hand signals, and they're going to get real-time data out. And when that happens, the court's finally going to go, well, if other people are doing this and it's out of control, then we're going to control it by putting it on video. That's what's going to happen, but that's what they should just do now.
Mm-hmm. Anybody have a contrary thought on that? Ben, what do you think about streaming or video broadcasting court proceedings?
I wish I had a big contrary position to Ernie, but I largely agree with him. I think the way that they got around this is fantastic. It shows a fair amount of creativity. My only worry is that, you know, transcripts are kind of sparse as far as, you know, inflection and what the tone is. And it definitely, when you sit down and read one, you can read a sentence and go, well, did he say it this way or that way? And that's going to make a big difference as to, you know, the tenor of the testimony. One thing that I'd like to add, though, to what Ernie said is that he said there's a worry that broadcasting these cases live would, you know, turn it into a circus. Another big worry, and especially a worry that the Supreme Court's talked about, is that they don't want the lawyers making an argument to the media because they're getting, you know, because the media can film this and rebroadcast it. They want the lawyers making an argument to the court. And I could definitely see some lawyers who would take that opportunity to make that argument to the media as opposed to the court. But especially if you're in a forum like the Supreme Court, you would just be silly to not take every second of that time to make the best legal argument you could, as opposed to going for the sound bites.
Right. So we were talking a minute ago about the media outside the courtroom. This actually turns the courtroom into part of the media when things are being generated there that go out to the rest of the world. David, any thoughts on this?
Well, actually, I think the last time I was on the show, we talked pretty extensively about this, because that week mm-hmm. was when the initial decision came down from the Supreme Court. And, you know, it's so funny because the court decided this on what they termed a procedural ground. And I mean, for the sake of appearances, I guess it was kind of a procedural ground. This was all about the modification of the local rules. But, you know, it's interesting to note that the Ninth Circuit, or circus, if you will, was interested in broadcasting these proceedings. And they made an attempt to make that happen before the bench trial of the Prop 8 case, you know, started. And, you know, so, okay, they didn't follow the procedural grounds, and the Supreme Court sort of slaps them on the wrist and says, oh, look, you did this all wrong. This is why we're not going to allow it. But at the same time, then they let in all this sort of fleeting dicta about all the reasons why cameras might not be a great idea in the federal courts. To contrast this heavily, though, I mean, if we look at the state court system, most of the state courts have ways in which the media can get in with cameras. And they seem to be pretty effective at controlling it. And, you know, I don't see that largely like a lot of the concerns that are at least in the Supreme Court's view, that might affect the federal trial process it doesn't seem like they've really affected the state trial process. And I mean, yeah, sure, there are some bad examples. Who could forget the OJ case? And I can't remember which Supreme Court justice it was, but he quipped at one point that he was just happy he wasn't as famous as Judge Ito, because obviously the case had become such a circus. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, another unfortunate thing is the fact that we're talking mostly about public legal proceedings. So if you're in the area where the legal proceeding is going on, you can effectively go into court and watch it live. Why shouldn't you be able in this day and age to watch it streaming on the internet or watch it from your home while it's going on live, just because you don't want to go down to the courthouse? All good questions. And go ahead, Ben.
I was just going to say an interesting thing that's been cropping up in the past couple of months now. I know the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court released an opinion recently that dealt with this, and I think there was a federal court that did it too. Courts have a procedure that they will generally close down the courtroom during jury selection, because what happens is at a trial court, they generally aren't very big, and they'll bring in, you know, 40 or 50 jurors at a time, and all of the jurors will pile into the seats, and, you know, they'll slowly be filtered into the jury box, and they'll be asked a series of questions. And the practice was, until very recently, to close down the courtroom and say no spectators are allowed there during that time. And two courts recently that I can remember, at least, have said that that's unconstitutional. You're violating the defendant's right to a public trial. And it's a big jump, I'll admit, from there to here, from, you know, closing down the courtroom during jury selection to being a violation of your right to a public trial. But I could imagine one day in the distant future where if you don't have the right to have your trial broadcast live or even filmed live, that would be a violation of your right to a public trial. I think that'd be a really interesting twist to have that, you know, that right to have anybody be able to be in your trial, not just the number of people who could fit in the courtroom.
Yeah, I agree. We're headed in that direction. Before we get to our final stories, I want to take a break real quick and thank our sponsor, GoToMeeting. If you go to gotomeeting.com/twill, you can get a 30-day free trial of this wonderful service, which otherwise is just $49 a month. So go ahead and get your free trial and give it a go. We all have people that we have to meet with in our jobs, and the last thing I have time to do is jump in my car and drive hours away for what should be a one-hour meeting. I simply don't have the time. That's why I use GoToMeeting. I can have meetings right from my desk as if I were in the room with the people I'm meeting with. And that's indispensable. It saves me time and money, and I can get more done. Here's a suggestion. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. You can use GoToMeeting for sales presentations, product demos, training sessions, collaborating on documents, and more. So please do sign up for the 30-day free trial, and you can have your first GoToMeeting tomorrow. It includes phone and voice over IP conferencing. So try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Visit gotomeeting.com/twill. So let's talk about the FINRA stuff first. We have a link in the show notes about a company that forced an employee to delete his LinkedIn profile because Ernie, this reminds me of something you mentioned earlier in the show where judges were asked not to friend attorneys on Facebook, where folks are just in, if they're in these highly regulated industries like the medical profession or the financial industry, social media just might not even be an option for them. And it's in this case, FINRA doesn't make the rules, but they provide guidance to individual firms about how they're going to let their employees use these services. And this particular fellow who was a contact of Tack Anderson, who was writing over at Newcom Biz, said, hey, you know, don't freak out, but I have to take down my LinkedIn page. Do you guys, what do you think? Do you think that we're going to see more and more of this or less and less of this kind of thing? Ernie?
I think for the short term, we're definitely going to see more of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, because you know, controversies like this, the deal with Google Buzz and with Facebook, this just raises the antenna for companies when they look at this and they say, wait a minute, you know, here are companies at the cutting edge of social networking and they're tripping up with people's privacy. Now, meanwhile, over here, we've got regulatory requirements and we've got business concerns. We certainly don't need a PR mess to top it all off. And, you know, how are we going to manage things so that, you know, and what they're really worried about mostly is disclosure. I mean, you know, you don't want people saying things in their Twitter stream that would need to be cleared or managed or, you know, approved if it was put in a formal press release. But if, you know, corporations are going to be held to a standard that, you know, certain key employees, you know, information on their Twitter streams or Facebook pages can constitute some sort of regulated disclosure, I mean, they're just going to say, hell with this. We're not going to let you do it because they can't possibly manage it and they can't foresee how the problems will arise. And back to what I said earlier, I mean, if Google and Facebook can't foresee how problems will arise, problems which to us look pretty obvious, then how is somebody in a company that isn't familiar with social networking going to foresee these problems? They're not.
Right. Over on our Facebook page, Dean Poirier chimes in and says he's heard of four cases recently where Facebook postings were a factor in an employee being discharged. And then Mi Jin Yu says, and of course, at the front end of hiring, as we all know, employers have not hired based on pictures and words on a potential employee's Facebook, MySpace, etc. The thing that strikes me as unique about this situation is you here, it sounds like, have employees using social media in precisely the way that a company might like, you know, using LinkedIn to expand their professional network. And there's no indication that there was any kind of impropriety going on. It was just that because they're in this industry where the way that they communicate with the public is so tightly regulated, they're going to be asked not to communicate in that sort of way. So, you know, there goes your link to the outside world. Ben, do you have any thoughts on this?
I just want to echo what other people said. It seems like the Florida Bar, too, where the Florida Bar is really trying to clamp down on what lawyers can do online. And my feeling is this is going to get worse before it gets better, both as far as regulatory agencies and what in-house groups do. In a lot of companies, they're, no offense to the older generation, they're still run by the older generation who don't quite grok what's going on here. They don't understand that this is actually a good way to get out information. And especially with something like agents and brokers, their job is communication. Their job is to sell things. And if you're trying to clamp down on the ways and places that they can sell things, you're probably doing something wrong. That's like saying to your door-to-door salesman, you know, 30, 40 years ago, hey, we don't want you to knock on doors. We understand that there's some people who don't like being interrupted in the middle of dinner. You're not going to sell books if you're not allowed to knock on the doors.
Wow, that sounds like a rule I could get behind, actually. David, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a little bit here. And as an attorney who has worked in-house previously, I can at least understand the concerns of the firms and corporations who are looking at these problems. I mean, this day and age, I mean, sometimes we think of it as a dichotomy in our lives between our professional lives and our personal lives. But more and more, it seems that those two areas are converging and the lines are very fuzzy. As you have a presence online, I mean, are you speaking on behalf of the company that you work for or are you speaking personally? And what happens if in your LinkedIn page, you've got your personal contacts in there, which are just your friends, and then you have professional ones at the same time. Is this like another channel of communication that a company should have control over? I mean, this is something that we even worry about on our own blog at Technically Legal. You know, we have our own disclosures on there that, you know, our views that we express on the website are not necessarily the views of our employers. And it doesn't really surprise me, I guess, that the company would take this strong of a stance and require someone to shut down their LinkedIn page because LinkedIn is more of a professional service. You tend to have business contacts on there. And as you've mentioned, this is a highly regulated industry where it's really important that you make the proper disclosures when you're communicating with your clients. And I would, you know, if I was in the standpoint of the in-house attorneys, I'd be concerned that this is just another point of liability that the company has to worry about. And let's do our best then to shut it down before something does actually go wrong. And that way we don't even have to worry about it. And we can wait and see what happens, what everybody else does. And if people's opinions change, then hey, maybe we could change our policies. That's not a hard thing to do.
Yeah. Do you think it's too much to ask for companies that find themselves facing this new FINRA guideline or ruling, whatever we're going to call it here, where a LinkedIn page, a profile page on LinkedIn is considered an individual representative registered website, which means I assume that certain rules have to be complied with and disclosures have to be made. Don't you think that they could just say, okay, well, all of your LinkedIn pages, Facebook pages, et cetera, we're just going to treat the same way as we treat our official corporate page. And you guys can just comply and we'll make sure our compliance people are taking care of what I's need to be dotted and T's need to be crossed so that you can continue using those services. You know, is that just too big a burden, or is that perhaps the way that companies should be thinking about going? Ernie, what do you think?
Well, I'd be interested in what David has to think, because he worked inside of a company and it sounds like, you know, he was keenly sensitive to those issues. I mean, you know, I don't really, you know, I want there to be more social interaction. I want people to be more open-minded. I want these tools to grow. You know, I mean, I think that's, you know, people who've listened to me know that that's what I want. At the same time, I recognize that people have valid concerns. Corporations have valid concerns. And this is a really new medium and there are no rules. And, you know, organizations don't like environments where there aren't patterns that they can observe and follow or dictate. And, you know, I don't know. That's so, yeah, I'd be curious to see what David has to think, say about it.
David, do you think a corporate compliance department would just quit en masse if they were asked to also look after everybody's social media doings?
Well, that's totally possible, especially since everybody seems to have at least some hand in social media these days. You know, like, well, first of all, I mean, I really was kind of playing devil's advocate there. And, you know, I am very pro social media, but you know, as attorneys, we have a responsibility to our clients. And when we're in-house attorneys, that means that we have a responsibility to the corporation to make, you know, to provide the right guidance on legal issues. And when you're in-house or even when you're any kind of attorney, you tend to be a little bit risk averse and you try to avoid all points of liability that you can possibly see. You know, if it's foreseeable, then let's try to avoid it. And that way we only have to worry about the stuff that we couldn't foresee. What I would be really interested to see, though, is like there's got to be some sort of middle ground. There has to be ways in which a corporation can have some sort of policies whereby an employee who's engaging in forms of social media, whether it's a LinkedIn page or a Facebook page, they sort of assume their own liability and they're not they make the proper disclosures on their page that they're not necessarily speaking on behalf of the corporation. I guess in the financial services industry or any other industry where it's highly regulated, that's really difficult to do because those regulations are so strict and you have those oversight bodies and the federal agencies which are, you know, constantly looking out for people violating those regulations. But certainly like the average corporation, you know, they probably, most corporations these days do seem to have policies in place internally about, you know, disclosures about when you're speaking on behalf of the company and when you're not. So, you know, I'd really like to see these tools grow too. And there are certainly legal mechanisms that we can use, like contract law and requiring employees to sign on to policy agreements, making them aware of policies through the employee handbooks and stuff that can establish what's the right way to go about recreating that dichotomy between personal and professional lives, or maybe allowing them to merge, because maybe what you want is your employees to be very vocal and very positive about the company, or in some cases, very negative. Sometimes both ways is good. And, you know, see things sort of become a bit more transparent.
So, hey, before we get to our last couple of stories here, I usually try and do a tip of the week and a resource of the week for our listeners and viewers, but time just sort of got away from me this week. So if you guys have any tips or resources either off the tops of your heads now that you want to share, or if you want to think about it, and then I'll ask you again at the end of the show. I think I will let you guys handle that for us this week. So
anybody can chime in on that, Denise?
Sure. Go ahead.
There's a program that I just stumbled upon last week. It's called Fastcase. It's a program for the iPhone. You can download it, and it's not very fast, but it provides searchable statutes and case law for, it seems, all 50 states and the federal government, which I've used it a couple of times. And like I said, slow, which isn't a plus, but it's always found what I was looking for, which is an extremely useful thing to have in your pocket.
And it's free.
And it's
free. Yes, and it's free.
In fact, the CEO of Fastcase I've been in contact with, and we might have them on the show in the next couple of weeks if we can iron out the logistics of that, just to introduce folks to the program and what it can do. I haven't used it yet because I do have it downloaded to my iPhone, and it does look like a great resource to have handy. But unlike most iPhone apps, it makes you register before you go ahead and use it, and that just kind of put me off a bit and made me think about whether I needed to use it right then. I suppose in an emergency where I really need access to some sort of case law on the fly, then I might register and give it a go. But that was just kind of a big hurdle to me. And I don't know. Does that strike you as something that is out of place in an app?
It was certainly strange, but I mean, I've got a Twitter app. I had to register with Twitter before I could use that. I mean, the difference is that I'm registering with Fastcase, and it's a Fastcase app. But they did ask for a little more information than I would have liked. But it's the kind of thing where if you really wanted that information, it's available a lot of other places. It seemed like they weren't going to divulge it, so I wasn't super worried about giving them that information.
Right. Okay. So, resource of the week is Fastcase, free legal research. Downloadable for a mobile platform of your choice. I only have it for the iPhone, but I assume it's a cross-platform kind of thing. There's also a Fastcase website, and I assume that's the tie-in, is that they want to get you using their legal research services, whether it's mobile or not mobile. Okay, so maybe one of the most fun stories we have had in a long time. This is somebody that I actually worked with very briefly when I was a summer associate, a really well-known Hollywood attorney named Peter Paterno, who has represented Metallica forever, and also a lot of other folks in the entertainment industry. He wrote a cease and desist letter to on behalf of Joe Walsh, the musician, former Eagle, to Joe Walsh, the politician, someone running for Congress, who had made a campaign song out of Joe Walsh's song, Lead the Way. And I'm going to go ahead and just read some of this letter here. I don't want to read the whole thing because it's so long, but we do have it in the show notes, and I encourage people to check it out. Ernie, you were talking about cease and desist letters that were written for public consumption. I think this one certainly was. Here Peter writes, "Dear Mr. Walsh, we represent Joe Walsh, not you, but the musician who plays guitar with the Eagles. Joe wrote a song called Walk Away. A lot of people know this song. That's why when they heard your campaign song Lead the Way, they noticed that it was the same song as Walk Away, but with peculiar lyrics. As a candidate for Congress, you probably have a passing familiarity with many of the laws of this great country of ours. It's possible, though, that laws governing intellectual property are a little too arcane and insufficiently populist for you to have really spent much time on. We're writing because we think laws are important, and it might be beneficial to your potential future career as a congressman if you were more aware of them." And he goes on in this sort of funny, sarcastic vein to lay out the terms of the Copyright Act, et cetera, and suggest that they promptly comply with the request that they take down this campaign song. And they close by saying, "We'd like you to do that so that we don't have to go all Jackson Brown on you," referring to the fact that Jackson Brown song was used in the McCain campaign. And they successfully did manage to stop Senator McCain from using that song. Now here, it's a little bit more nuanced than there, because it, you know, I went through and then I read Joe Walsh, the candidate's response, and apparently they did not just lift the song, but they created something of a parody of the song with, you know, a different band and musicians and their own lyrics that they wrote, and, you know, that they're contending that it would have been fair use. Now, they're not really standing by that contention too strongly, because I think they did pull the thing down, and I haven't been able to find it online. If anyone can in the chat room, I'd love to be able to point to it and get our own take on it. Did you guys have any success in finding it, or have you checked any of this out, David?
I poked around a little bit, but I haven't seen the video myself. From what I read in the response, it seemed like that they had created an entirely new song, like a new recording. And it sounds like they, you know, they did their due diligence at least a little bit and intended this to be a parody. And so, of course, under the Copyright Act, fair use is a defense to infringement. And that's, of course, decided on a case-by-case basis, where a judge will go through and applying those wonderful four factors in the Copyright Act, determine whether or not a particular use is a fair use and therefore not infringement, or at least in that particular case. They could have a very strong argument here that what they created was in fact a parody and that it qualifies for fair use. And so that could certainly be grounds for not taking down the video wherever it is or not using the video.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he made that great argument that it was fair use and laid out all the reasons why, but now I can't find it anywhere. It's not available on YouTube or on the campaign website any further. So it's kind of too bad if they did go to all that trouble to try and make sure that they were going to be able to use the song, that they haven't stuck to their fair use guns. I don't know that I would have expected that from someone running for Congress under the "quote unquote Tea Party" banner. Ernie, did you check all this out? And what do you think
I thought the letter was classic from the lawyer, and I thought that the response from the congressman, you know, attempted to do two things. One, he attempted to parry with the attorney and being clever, which he should have just written a straight up letter and just said, "Here's what I'm doing and why I'm doing it," and he did. Say that it was parody, and of course the copyright lawyer had anticipated that and had a paragraph in there. So I give, you know, if we're scoring this, you know, like American Idol, I'm going to give, you know, a 9.9 to the copyright attorney, and I'm going to give a 7 to the candidate, because I'm not sure what the law really is in this instance. I think that the Acuff Rose case, which candidate Joe Walsh cited, was the one where they did the parody of Roy Orbison's "Oh Pretty Woman." As I understand it, that case, the reason why they had to claim parody is they forgot to pay the compulsory licensing fee, or they didn't get it done in time, and then it was released, and so they had to go that route. But the case did establish that you could have, you know, commercial parody, which of course I guess makes sense, because otherwise Saturday Night Live wouldn't exist. But I don't think this congressman really intended it as parody. He was using it to help him in his campaign, and he basically just liked the fact that that song was there and people knew it, and he wanted to co-opt it. I don't think it was parody, but maybe that qualifies. So like I said, 9.9 to the copyright attorney and 7 to the candidate.
What do you think, Ben? How's your scoring on this?
I'm going to disagree with Ernie and you, Denise, a little bit. I thought that the attorney's letter, I mean, it was well written and he hit all of the points he should have. I thought it was a little on the snarky side for my taste. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have liked it to be a little more respectful. I mean, especially when you're doing something like this, that it seems like it was almost intended to be published on the internet. I just would have liked to see him be a little nicer about it. It seemed really snarky. As for whether or not this is parody, I definitely agree with Ernie on that. We've seen fair use expand recently, at least in my view. I think it's been expanding. But fair use with regard to music has always been this nebulous thing. In Campbell v. Acuff Rose, that, as Ernie said, was cited in the reply letter, that case was really the amount of the original song, Pretty Woman, that was used was like the initial guitar lick and then the theme of the song. It was very little. What I understand in this song is that they took the entire maybe some of the lyrics and all of the backing track, you know, all of the guitar parts they just copied over. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that you see Weird Al do, but Weird Al always gets permission to do that. He doesn't just do it and claim that it's parody, even though in those cases it very genuinely is parody, although he's not always parodying the song itself. So I'm not entirely sure that this would fall into fair use. The better part of valor in this case was definitely take it down.
Right, which they went ahead and did. Okay, well, maybe we can make this last story incorporate our tip of the week for folks, with the tip being that works created by the federal government from the USA.gov site, comes this statement, are not subject to copyright law. And there are no U.S. copyright restrictions on reproduction, derivative works, distribution, performance, or display of any work created by the U.S. government. And you can reproduce the work, prepare derivative works of the work, perform the work publicly, display the work, distribute copies, or digitally transfer the work to the public by sale or other transfer of ownership, or by rental, lease, or lending. Now, however, that gets a little bit more complicated when you're talking about photos that are available on whitehouse.gov, specifically it's Flickr photos, because apparently the Obama White House is now asserting that its photos may not be used in commercial or political materials, advertisements, emails, products, promotions, etc., that in any way suggests the approval or endorsement of the president, the first family, or the White House. Do you guys see any kind of conflict there? It seems to me like maybe what's getting confused, and we have a story here in the show notes from Wired Pen, are the doctrines of copyright and the doctrines of right of publicity. David, did you get a chance to take a look at this?
I did, and it was really interesting to read about, because I mean, certainly, as the story wrote notes from Wired Pen, that there really isn't any copyright in government-created works. And the story went on to note that they investigated who the photographer was, and it was, in fact, a White House photographer. So based on those guidelines, you would think that there is no copyright that would have vested in the photos themselves. But this really does seem much closer to either a misappropriation of likeness or a right of publicity type of a case, because both of the uses that they're talking about, and one was a billboard that was in Times Square, I think, and it featured a product name along with President Obama sitting there in one of the jackets. Mm-hmm. So obviously there was some sort of implication that President Obama was endorsing that particular line of clothing. And then you've got another use by PETA, of course, that's the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, not the People for Eating Tasty Animals. I don't know if you guys remember that. that involves the First Lady, and Michelle Obama was featured in a ad which says "fur free and fabulous," along with several other celebrities. And kind of clearly indicating, or at least maybe the implication is that Michelle Obama has some sort of connection to PETA, or that's the reason she doesn't wear fur. I think that the wording of what had appeared on the website, which sort of purports to restrict certain types of uses of the those photos, I think it might have been worded poorly. I don't know that, and I don't necessarily know that they were attempting to get at a copyright claim. Maybe whoever wrote that was just confused, and it just threw in the language anyways to cover all grounds. But there definitely seem to be these grounds to stop usage based on, like I said, a misappropriation of likeness theory or right to publicity.
Yeah. Ben, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I agree that, the publicity right is totally separate. I think one of the things that the author of the article that we were talking about was cluing in on is that if you go to the White House Flickr feed, one of the a disclaimer at the bottom of every photo says the photo may not be manipulated in any way and may not be used in commercial or political materials. I think they just needed to rephrase that a little bit and say the photo may not be manipulated in any way for use in commercial or political materials, because I can download that photo, and since the White House doesn't have a copyright on it, as long as it's for personal use, I could edit it, I could mock it up. If it's for political commentary, I could do pretty much whatever I wanted to that photo, and I think I'd be fine. But the problem comes in is when you're getting into the commercial use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they do seem really keyed in on this endorsement or associating the First Family with a commercial product aspect, which leads me to think that that the copyright issue is maybe not what they're primarily concerned with trying to control. Ernie, do you think the White House got confused here?
Yeah, I think that's what happened. I think that they're trying to prevent that, you know, those instances from recurring, and they just didn't word it properly. Because, I mean, especially with this administration, which has largely been pretty pro-sharing information. I mean, for God's sake, they got a Flickr feed.
They have a Flickr stream.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not like they're hiding from this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. There are a couple of reader, viewer, listener responses I wanted to go ahead and toss out there for a couple of our, you know, on topics that we have dealt with previously on the show. And then if you guys have any thoughts on these comments, please do chime in. I heard from Nicholas Campbell, who's a law student, and mentioned he thought the side conversation we had on episode 45 on the Facebook contact syncing app was great. And he'd been surprised more media outlets weren't addressing it. One thing the discussion missed, though, was that a user who syncs their contacts from their iPhone with Facebook also agrees that Facebook can collect all their data, names, phone numbers, and addresses for their own purposes. I found this greatly disturbing, as I have no control personally whether a friend who uses the sync feature sends my contact information to Facebook or a third party. Of course, I've never had this control, but the sync feature incentivizes people to give that information out and automates the collection process across millions of users. Thus, even if I never used Facebook, they are already gathering information on me. Now, this relates to an iPhone app or mobile app, I think we were talking about, where folks can populate their local contact address book with information on their contacts from Facebook. Do you guys think that this is a privacy issue along the lines of what we were talking about in the early part of the show? Ben?
It's certainly interesting. I have to think about it a little more to really figure out whether or not it was actionable, whether or not whether or not you could do something about this. Mm-hmm. It strikes me, at least initially, as the kind of thing where if somebody else has your information and they're giving it away, there's not much you can do about that. It sucks, but
definitely.
I don't know what you can do.
Anybody else have thoughts about mobile apps that are attempting to harvest information from social networks and make it more usable, but perhaps don't meet up with users' expectations in the process?
Yeah, I've been using the Dragon Dictation app on my iPhone, and it's fantastic. And that's one that caught flack because it's free and it's amazing. But it caught flack because it captured all of the contact information in your iPhone initially. Then they said, well, you can turn that off if you want to, and some people did. I did not turn it off. But I noticed that it was really good when I dictated people's names that were in my contact address book of spelling them correctly. And that's why they said that they did this, was so that they could get more accuracy. So they quickly disabled that when people complained. And again, I think the problem is, in some cases, you have something that is truly useful and not at all insidious in any way, but there's a lack of communication or a lack of, you know, giving the user the option. You know, so that triggers a problem. Then you get the situation where the reason why they don't give the user the option or they don't talk about it is because they're trying to make money and do something, as Facebook did with its advertising, and they just want to enable this to make the money part of it work for them. And, you know, so I feel bad for the companies that are doing something legitimate, but the first cure-all is let people know what you're doing. And if you can give them an option, give them an option. Because if you explain to people why you're using it, then they can say, okay, I understand that. That makes sense. So I think that's really the problem with a lot of these things is people just rushing these products out the door. At least, you know, I mean, they spend a lot of time developing the product, but they don't spend as much time as they should thinking about how it's going to be received. And so they, you know, they're in a hurry, they push it out, and then the controversy erupts.
Right. And then the other email I wanted to get to was a comment to our last show. And just real quick, I wanted to bring up the case. You remember we talked about the iiNet case that had an interesting outcome against the film industry, which was seeking to, let's see, let me get to exactly here. This was the one with the 200-page judgment where iiNet was being sought to be held liable by the film industry for various acts of its users. And the court found that no, that wasn't the case. And iiNet had no control over the BitTorrent activity that was going on its system. Robert J.G. Cooper wrote in that he is from Australia, a new law graduate and a techno nut, found the case interesting. He gave a link to the full 200-page judgment, which I'll go ahead and put in the show notes here if anyone wants to curl up with that. Let's see. He says that, well, here's iiNet, and then he's talking about Ostl2, which is a free service that provides free internet access to Australian legal materials. Oh, that's where he got a copy of the judgment. Okay, so he's telling us about a resource. Maybe this can be our second resource of the week for those seeking Australian law. Its broad public policy agenda is to improve access to justice through better access to information. To that end, we have become one of the largest sources of legal materials on the net with over 4 million searchable documents. He says that their sources are not authoritative. That is left to the official report series. It often has judgments more quickly than other sources, as well as court transcripts and transcripts. And as a free tool, it's very useful. Okay, so thanks, Robert, for writing in about that resource. And let's see, I think I'll just go around one more time and see if you guys have anything else on your mind before we go ahead and wrap the show. David?
Oh, no, all good on my end.
All good on your end. Well, thank you so much for coming back with us.
It was a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Ben, do you have anything further on your mind or anything you're planning for Technically Legal you want to plug?
No, but I would like to plug Technically Legal, as you've done a couple of times so far. So please visit us, www.technicallylegal.org. We've got a podcast and a blog there. And you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle's @TechLegal.
Great. And you are @Snitty, correct?
Yes, I am.
Yes.
S-N-I-T-T-Y.
Right. And David, you are David_O'Brien with an E on Twitter?
Close. Oh, it's
one more time.
@D_OBRIEN.
There we go. Okay. And I know we can find both of you at technicallylegal.org. Do you have other locations on the web where people can find you out and follow your stuff? Ben?
If you really want, my personal blog is esotericappeal.com. But that, I mean, that varies. That's everything from my musings on a book that I'm reading to, you know, some interesting science experiment that I read about recently. So it's rarely legal related. I'm just a disclaimer for that.
Cool. And David, is there anywhere where we can find your apple pie recipes?
No apple pie recipes, at least I haven't started posting those yet. You can find some of my blog postings over at the Citizen Media Law Project, which is a project that's hosted out of Harvard's Berkman Center, and that is www.citmedialaw.org/blog.
Wonderful. And Ernie, thanks so much for coming back on the show. We're glad you have recovered from the big game.
Yes, it was great to be here, and I enjoyed talking with Dave and Ben. It was a great panel, and I look forward to hopefully running into them in meat space, as they say, one day.
And folks, you can find Ernie at Ernie Attorney on Twitter or ErnieTheAttorney.net on the web. And please do email us your comments and thoughts about the show. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Check out our Facebook page before the show so you can chime in on some of the things that we're going to be talking about. That again is denise.howell.net/FB. And as always, I had a great time and look forward to seeing you again soon. Take care.
Hey, bye.